Barbara, so that every mouth can be fed. Oh, me Israelite. Get up in the morning, slaving for bread, so that every mouth can be fed.
What does the medley of music you've just heard have in common? Well, apart from the obvious fact that they're all examples of Jamaican pop music, what these records have in common is that they were all major hits in the British pop charts. The selection you heard, spanning the mid-60s up to the 70s, is by no means exhaustive of the stock of Jamaican records which have been hits in the British charts. Here in Britain, young blacks have evolved their own indigenous style of the music. The emergence in the late 70s of the two-tone bands like The Specials, The Beat, Madness, and later on UB40 reflected the fact that Jamaican pop had become now an essential and dynamic element of British popular music culture. Now, you might have noticed that so far I haven't used the word reggae, which is what Jamaican pop had been called since the late 60s. The reason why I avoided using the word is because the music was not always known as reggae. It went through several stages of evolution and development before it became reggae. In fact, Millie Small, the first Jamaican recording artist to have a hit in the British charts, was working in the R&B format 20 years ago when she had her first success with My Boy Lollipop. movement of labor from the Caribbean to Britain during the late 50s and early 60s coincided with the birth of a local recording industry in Jamaica. Faced with a chronic shortage of labor, coupled with the strength of the trade union movement, Britain turned to her colonies in the Caribbean as a source of cheap labor. London Transport embarked on an advertising campaign in Barbados, for example, whilst the Ministry of Health under Enoch Powell recruited nurses. Mr. Macmillan, the Prime Minister of the time, summed up the position when he said, "The doors of this country will always be open to the Commonwealth." The early Jamaican migrants, like their other Caribbean counterparts, whilst adapting to the new discipline of an advanced capitalist society and the British way of life, also brought their own native Caribbean cultural heritage to bear on their existence in Britain. Imported homegrown music was, of course, an ingredient of central importance. In response to increasing demand for the new music from home, a whole new record retail system was established, more or less independent of the existing retail network for British pop music. By the early 60s, the sound system, those powerful hi-fis through which the music is transmitted, and the blues dance held in people's homes, had become established institutions of the Caribbean communities in Britain's inner cities. Faced with opposition from hostile forces within British society like the police, local authorities, intolerant neighbours, racists, Jamaican pop music became Britain's first underground music. The existence of this external market in Britain and later North America was a crucial factor in the development of the Jamaican recording industry and the music itself. The impoverished local market by itself could not sustain the pace of development of the local industry, and whilst Jamaica remained the home of the music, London became its capital. The fact, as I mentioned earlier, that the music has consistently been able to penetrate the pop charts here means that it has regularly been able to surface from its underground existence and make an impact on the British record buying public. Its impact was not limited to Joe Public. Inevitably, it began to make its influence felt on leading practitioners of British rock music during its early stages. Here is a response from the Beatles.
Oh, bloody, oh, blada, life goes on.
Not only has reggae become an essential ingredient of British pop, more significantly, the music has been able to gain international recognition and popularity. It exists alongside other popular metropolitan forms like soul, rock, jazz, funk, and disco, and also influences these dominant forms. From Iceland to Japan, from Finland to South Africa, from Brazil to Australia, this highly danceable music with its insistent, pulsating beat, its sharp cutting rhythms, its penetrating pathos, protest, its profundity and its power, now enjoys worldwide popularity. What you've just been listening to are examples of Japanese, French, Swedish, and Danish reggae. Now, in spite of the ubiquity of reggae, there is still, regrettably, a tremendous amount of ignorance about the history of its origins, the changes it has undergone, the nature of its lyricism, and the different styles and forms of the music. For example, the influence of rhythm and blues on Jamaican pop during its formative stages has led some commentators to describe reggae as an offshoot of R&B. One distinguished rock critic even went as far as to describe the music as rock and roll turned inside out. It is my contention that the process through which reggae evolved did not begin, as it has often been claimed, when Jamaicans began to imitate the R&B sound in the 50s, but that its roots go back at least a century to the folk culture of rural and urban Jamaica. It would, of course, take a tremendous amount of resources and a lifetime of study to completely unravel the knotted thread of the music's evolution. I shall try to identify the different components of the music, to describe the different stages of its evolution, to examine the language and contents of its lyricism, to identify the different styles and forms that the music takes, and to deal with those other musical forms which might have exerted some kind of influence on the music at different stages of its development. Contributors to the series of programs will include Toots Hibbert of Toots and the Maytals, Jimmy Cliff, Marcia Griffiths, Joe Higgs, Bobby Ellis, Cedric Brooks, Freddie McGregor, Jackie Bernard of the Kingstonians, King Stitt, Marjorie Wiley of the Jamaica School of Music, Professor Rex Nettleford of the University of the West Indies, Garth White, respected Jamaican musicologist, and others. I hope you will enjoy the journey. Let us begin at the beginning. That was Pirate Days by the group Culture, taken from their album Two Sevens Clash. The point that the song is making is that the earliest known inhabitants of Jamaica is not its present predominantly black African descended population, but a tribe of South American Indians called Arawaks. The island was discovered by the explorer Christopher Columbus in 1492. The Spanish occupied Jamaica for over 150 years before it was captured by the British in 1655. Little is known of the musical heritage of the Arawak Indians and whether or not any elements have been able to survive in the folk culture of the island. What is known is the fact that by the middle of the 17th century, when the British colonization of the island began, the Arawaks had been virtually exterminated. There was some interbreeding with the African slaves that the Spanish had brought to the island in the 16th century. These slaves were known as the Maroons. When their Spanish masters were defeated by the British, they took to the hills and for more than a century waged guerrilla warfare against them. Eventually, they were able to win significant concessions from the British, and by the end of the 18th century, hostilities had all but ceased. The Maroons were granted their own settlements, which survive to the present day. Apart from the Maroons, Jamaica's population can be traced back to the period of British colonization. They were planters, soldiers and sailors, convicts and indentured servants from England, Scotland and Ireland. However, the largest section of the population consisted of slaves brought over from Africa. They came mainly from the regions of Ghana, Nigeria and the Congo. They were, of course, brought over to work on the sugar plantations. The question that Winston Rodney is asking his fellow countrymen is, of course, a rhetorical one. Slavery, which was abolished in Jamaica in 1838, is still very much at the forefront of the people's national consciousness. Some commentators have stated that this is so because the very colonial relations to which slavery was central still persist in Jamaica today. Perhaps this explains the preoccupation of so many Jamaican singers with the theme of slavery. Towards the end of the 19th century, the population was supplemented by Syrian or Lebanese merchants and indentured laborers from India and a few Chinese. The coming together of these peoples of different races and cultures in an environment new to them all, based on social relations determined by the nature and the needs of a sugar plantation economy, provided the basis for the evolution of Jamaican society and culture. Historians and sociologists have described societies such as Jamaica as Creole societies. The Barbadian historian Edward Brathwaite, in his book The Development of Creole Society in Jamaica, defines a Creole society as, and I quote, the result of a complex situation where a colonial polity reacts as a whole to external metropolitan pressures and at the same time to internal adjustments made necessary by the juxtaposition of master and slave, elite and laborer, in a culturally heterogeneous relationship. This is what Professor Rex Nettleford of the University of the West Indies has to say about it.
In fairness, the people who have so described it are talking about a native-born and native-bred society whose whole cosmology really is rooted in the events which have taken place over the past 450, 500 years with the meeting of different peoples in from outside the region, in the region, and creating through relationships of one kind or another a distinctively new ethos, worldview, if you like, and we're about going our business. And I use the term Creole in the proper sense of the term, native-born, native-bred. Some people tend to go ethnic on it, but in truth and in fact, you can talk about Creole whites, Creole blacks, and of course the Creole, the brown man in the Caribbean who tends to feel that he has a certain legitimacy because he's the organic result of the circumstances of the past 500 years. In the case of Jamaica, of course, our indigenous peoples, the Arawaks, died out fairly early or were absorbed. So much of what came to be the consolidation of the society was really based on the relationships between the usurpers, if you like, and in our cases, largely the civilizations of Africa meeting the civilizations of Western Europe on foreign soil.
By the end of the 19th century, Jamaica had evolved a rich and vibrant folk culture rooted in the folk traditions of our former slaves. The coming together of the two great traditions of Europe and Africa had produced something not quite European and not quite African, something new and unique, a Creole culture. Jamaica had by then also evolved its first homegrown dance music to enjoy national popularity. This was the mento. Within the mento, albeit in embryonic form, lay the basis of the rhythmic orientation of today's reggae music. The emergence of the mento therefore represents a decisive turning point in the history of creolization. It represents the culmination of a complex of historical processes set in motion during the 17th century, where different cultural inputs underwent acculturation and transformation, incorporation and rejection, until something new and unique had emerged. The mento still enjoys a significant degree of popularity in Jamaica today. Here's an example of a modern mento band who play regularly at dances and bars in the Kingston and St. Andrews area.
La 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 la.
Today's reggae music is full of resonances from the era of Mento. As we shall discover as we go along, the Mento is a constant thread running through the evolution of modern popular Jamaican music, exerting its influence at each stage of the music's development. What were the different strands of musical styles and forms, both sacred and secular, which made up the musical matrix of the folk culture out of which the Mento emerged? Before I begin a survey of the stock of musical forms to be found within the folk culture approximately a century ago, there are a number of important points which need to be taken into account. To begin with, we need to take into account the fact that the interaction between the cultural heritage of Europe and Africa in Jamaica took place within the framework of the plantation system based on slavery. Secondly, the cultural practices and values of the Europeans were the dominant ones, whilst those of the African were suppressed and denigrated by official colonial society. Thirdly, the British settlers did not constitute a culturally homogeneous group, consisting as it were of English, Scottish, Irish, and probably some Welsh. Similarly, the Africans came from different tribes with different customs. We need also to take into account the fact that, as of necessity, much of the cultural practices of the slaves had to be shrouded in great secrecy, some of them surviving as mere fragments from an ancient memory. Another important factor is the movement of planters and slaves to Jamaica from neighboring territories. For example, during the American War of Independence, some loyalists fled to Jamaica with their slaves. Again, during the Haitian Revolution, some French planters fled to Jamaica with their slaves too. Finally, the Maroon settlements would have been an important repository of African musical elements and perhaps traces of the music of the Arawak Indians, Jamaica's original inhabitants. Here are some Maroon songs rendered by children from the Bamboo Old Age School in Jamaica.
Oh, yeah, my own.
Needless to say, the slaves were not allowed to bring musical instruments with them to the New World, but replicas of instruments from Africa were soon constructed from memory. Early observers noted the Coromanti flute, a bassoon-like instrument about a yard in length made from the porous branch of the trumpet tree, which is native to Jamaica. Nose flutes and bentas, something like the Jew's harp, and stringed instruments made from gourds and horsehair are also noted. Amongst the earliest drums noted was the cotta drum, the gumbe box drum, which is thought to be Ghanaian in origin, and the tambu drum. The drum, which was associated with warfare in the minds of the colonialists, was outlawed with severe penalties for both master and slave for infringement. In spite of this, the drum remained a primary force in the folk culture. In addition to the instruments noted by early observers, a whole array of crude instruments were fashioned to meet the needs for music making and dancing. These include various double-headed drums, banjos, fifes, rumba box or marimbas, rattles, shakers, bamboo basses, bamboo quartz, and various forms of percussive instruments. Later, other European instruments would have been added, like clarinet, saxophone, fiddle, trumpets, and so on. Now, having said all that, are we really in a position to isolate the African and European musical elements within the folk forms to be found in Jamaica a century ago? Let's hear what some of the experts in Jamaica have to say about this. We will hear firstly from Pam O'Gorman, principal of the Jamaica School of Music, followed by Marjorie Wiley, head of the folk department at the School of Music, and Olive Lewin, noted musicologist and folk singer. Now, can they isolate the African elements within the folk culture?
Undoubtedly, yes. In fact, I think it's much easier to identify the African elements than it is to identify the European ones. The whole polyrhythmic nature of the music is very African. The performance style is very African. The use of the voice, a very relaxed use of the voice. The percussive approach to not only singing, but also to the use of instruments, very African. And I might say, you know, where the singing is concerned, this is quite interesting, because we have found in the school here that to find a suitable reggae singer is not always as easy as you might think, because there's a definite percussive, biting element that you get in the voice that you won't find in a ballad singer, for instance. And the reggae voice is a very, very special one. There's also call and response patterns which you get in the music and is found very much in Jamaican folk music. And generally, you can say that the whole approach is certainly much more African.
I think so, quite clearly. I would think perhaps the most obvious element that still persists in the popular music of today is the element of call and response. A lead voice calling, other voices answering either in unison or in harmony. That is indeed African. Of course, an obvious factor also would be syncopation, but a particular kind of syncopation, in that we have the phenomenon of syncopated bars being followed by straight bars of rhythm, and this we find permeating all music in Jamaica. Syncopation refers to irregular stress in bars, not on the normal strong beats of the bar that you would find in white-oriented music. All black music is characterized by syncopation. Those are two elements. Obviously, the element of rhythm, the use of drums, and in particular hand-played drums, and the use of hand-played drums in batteries or sets, each one carrying different patterns, steady rhythm being maintained by one instrument where the other one cuts. That is strongly African. Those are the very obvious elements that we can point to, and there will be others that are indirect.
The answer to that, I suppose, is yes, but not half as much as we would like to or as we should, for the simple reason that in order to isolate African elements, we have to know more about the African music. And isolating is very difficult too, because we're so mixed. People who want to go back to Africa, you know, I think they'd have quite a problem to know which part of Africa to go back to. Because at this stage, though some of us are able to say, well, my great-great-great-grandparents came from Sierra Leone, or mine were from the Congo, after three generations here, you know, I don't have to tell you. So the first thing is that we would have to know more about the African elements, and then we'd have to study our own music far more seriously.
So much for the African elements, but can we also identify the European elements within the folk culture?
Yes, I think we can. I think you'll find this particularly in the revival element, where you have, of course, European hymns which are sung in an African performance style. But the melodic turns are, I think, pretty identifiably European. Many people feel, too, that in some respects the harmonic language is European. This is not as much as it used to be. I think in the old days when you used to get a 1-4-5 harmony, three-chord functional European harmony, yes. But you will also find, particularly in popular music today, that you're getting more parallel harmonies such as you find in European rock music, and which also come out of the resources or the techniques of certain instruments like the guitar. The other European element, of course, is the regular metrical rhythm that you get in a lot of Jamaican folk music. Particularly the quadrille, the revival, those types where you have had a very strong European influence. And this you find in reggae too, as you do in other forms of pop music.
I think what we owe to Europe, and perhaps to Wales in particular, is our harmonic sense. It is said that a good many missionaries, educators, what have you, who operated during the plantation period in Jamaica, came from Wales. And the Welsh have a particular approach to vocal music that one can readily identify with, having grown up in Jamaica. Not only that, but one finds the intonation of speech is very close to the Welsh. I remember walking on a street in Cardiff and stopping to ask directions and being thought to have been a mixture of Welsh and African because of the intonation of my speech. The Welsh sing in harmony. Naturally, each person finds his own level and falls naturally into this idea of four-part harmony and descant that is found in practically every tradition in Jamaica. We don't find that in England. You don't find that in Scotland. So of the British, I think perhaps we owe to the Welsh that kind of response to harmony. A good many of the scale patterns, the major scales, the minor modes, and so on, are definitely European derived. We cannot escape from that. The idea of strophic music, of verse and chorus, that is also very strongly European. And there are a good many wandering melodies that we can trace to a European origin.
It's easy to say that in some of our folk forms, we inherited a lot of the harmonic styles from Europe, the phrase structure, and even some of the melodic styles. Because most of the songs that have been popular and known for maybe 30, 40 years as Jamaican folk songs really have been ones that are pretty close to European type of melodies and harmonies and structure. But in order to know what we owe to Europe, we have to go with more deeply, both here and in Europe.
Once again, we heard from Pam O'Gorman, Marjorie Wiley, and Olive Lewin, and the answer seems to be yes on both counts, with some reservations from Miss Lewin. Good night.
Listen, people, listen to the workman's song, the workman's song. I sweat and strain every day, oh Lord. I work so hard trying to make it, Lord. No bread, no water, no place to rest, yeah. Sing the words of the world.
That was the first part of From Mento to Lover's Brock.